Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, media and social change, we'll look back at one short-lived magazine that shook America. Then, in light of the crisis in law enforcement, particularly on the Black community, we are rebroadcasting a look at the disparities that laid the groundwork for what happened in Ferguson. What is the impact of media? What is the media's role in political and social change? One short-lived U.S. publication called Ramparts changed a number of aspects of American politics and American journalism, at least for a while. In its short life, the publication exposed CIA torture, published photographs of napalmed Vietnamese children, and the diaries of Che Guevara. It served as a launching pad for numerous intellectuals, political leaders, and journalists, including Noam Chomsky, Bobby Seale, Seymour Hersh, William Grider, Jonathan Kozol, Christopher Hitchens, Angela Davis, even Brit Hume, who now serves as a Fox News anchor. The publication also put out the early works of writers such as Kurt Vonnegut, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and Nobel Literature Prize winner Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It spawned new publications, including Rolling Stone and Mother Jones. We're joined by Peter Richardson, who is the author of a book about Ramparts called A Bomb in Every Issue. And we also have with us Robert Scheer, who is one of the editors of the publication. And he is now the author of numerous books, co-host of Left, Right, and Center, and the founder of the internet publication Truth Dig. So welcome, Peter Richardson.
Thank you, Maria.
And welcome, Robert Scheer.
I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you back on the air with us. So I guess we should start with Peter Richardson to talk about the founding of Ramparts and the politics that it was born into, how it played into it, how it gave birth to it. This was the years of Kennedy, Pat Brown, Bay Area politics, anti-communism, and the Cuban Revolution. Tell us about that.
Well, Ramparts magazine actually started as a Catholic literary quarterly. It didn't have a strongly progressive political slant. The original vision was that it would put out things that were sympathetic to and supportive of sort of liberal Catholicism. But that changed very quickly when the original publisher, Edward Keating, hired Warren Hinkle as his executive editor. And it was Warren who began sort of juicing up the magazine, giving it a little bit more sensational content. But one of his chief accomplishments was recruiting Robert Scheer as the foreign correspondent focusing on Asia, Southeast Asia, and especially Vietnam, and then later Bob became the managing editor. And that changed the political direction of the magazine considerably.
Well, before we bring Robert Scheer on to talk about this, you wrote in the book a little bit about his own background and what the changes were that you saw at Ramparts. Talk about that, and let's then bring Bob in.
It was an important dimension to the success of the magazine. They had already sort of come up with a pretty good-looking magazine under the art direction of Dugald Sturmer. They had the showmanship from Warren Hinkle. They had the financial backing of Ed Keating. But what Bob added was a lot more political savvy and a lot of that more deeper ideological commitments, and a lot of that did reflect his background. He grew up in New York, and he went to City College. He came out to Berkeley. He was intensely interested in Asia, first China and then Vietnam. So he knew, and he went to Vietnam, and that distinguished him from a lot of people who were writing about it at that time. And he came back and told people, listen, everything you've been hearing about Vietnam is very badly garbled or just wrong. And that was a huge contribution to make at that time in the magazine's development, but also to the country's political discourse.
All right, Bob Scheer, let's bring you in.
You know, every time I hear Peter talk about his book, he makes it much more boring. The book is great. And what Peter managed to do, I mean, he's not a great radio interviewer as far as I'm concerned, but he's a terrific writer. And the book is a joy to read. And what he did is he captured the wild, crazy, free spirit of Ramparts. It was not ideological. I was a part of it. I was not, you know, the whole deal by any means, and not, maybe sometimes not even that important. Because first of all, let me just correct him on one thing. Even though it started as a Catholic literary quarterly, its early importance was that it strongly backed the farm workers and Cesar Chavez, who was himself Catholic, and took a very strong position on civil rights. And you have two streets in Los Angeles. You have Cesar Chavez Street down there, and you have Martin Luther King, as do most cities. And let me tell you, when we published those people and we celebrated them and gave opened it to them, which began actually before I was even involved, it was in the spirit of Pope John. It was in the spirit of a whole new Catholic awakening of social conscience. And we published Martin Luther King later on the war when the New York Times condemned him. And I think one thing Peter captures in his book, and I really would urge people to read it, because there's a lot of nonsense about the old media and now the Internet is supposed to be threatening it. The reason Ramparts existed is because the old established media wasn't doing its job. The New York Times basically supported the war. And when Martin Luther King came out against the war, they condemned him for his speech at Riverside, that historic, famous speech. We published the speech. And as Peter points out in his book, Martin Luther King actually came out publicly against the war because of a series that he read in Ramparts, where we exposed what the bombing was doing to the children of Vietnam, the murder. You know, after all, 3.5 million people died in that war, which we think now of no one defends, but, you know, oh, it was just a mistake and so forth. And so, you know, Ramparts had great variety. It was one of the things wrong with the left now is it's too rigid and politically correct. Ramparts was open. It was wild. Yes, there was room for meat. But, you know, the great thing about Ramparts is it wasn't narrow ideologically at all. And so I would make two points. One is it really examines the role of the mass media in condoning these wars like Vietnam and cheering it on. And it criticizes the mass media, as Ramparts did, for ignoring the civil rights movement at first and not supporting it vigorously, and certainly not supporting the connection of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And, you know, you mentioned that I'm now the editor of Truthdig, and I sometimes tell people Truthdig is Ramparts on speed. You know, because of the Internet, we can get things out. We published Kevin Tillman's article on Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, about the death of his brother, and Kevin was there in Afghanistan when his brother was killed, and that got millions of readers, something far beyond what Ramparts can do. But I think what we have to do, particularly on the left, is to get back that energy, that excitement, and that search for truth that Ramparts represented.
Well, you know, one of the things I thought was remarkable about the book and about Ramparts, and the book, again, is called A Bomb in Every Issue, and Peter Richardson, let's bring you back in on this, is that Ramparts forced the mainstream media to address these issues that they had been neglecting. So talk a bit about that first, and then let's talk about today. Is anybody actually forcing the mainstream media to do that? But talk about the historic aspect first.
What Ramparts was able to do was, as you say, force the mainstream media to cover its stories. Many of the big stories were whistleblower stories. And what Ramparts did was not only tell those stories, but publicize them in a way that forced the mainstream media to pick them up. The New York Times was especially open to that. It was a lot easier to cover some of these stories once Ramparts had broken them. And Ramparts pitched them to the New York Times specifically and kept score that way, how many times they could get an article onto the front page of the New York Times, because they knew they would reach a lot more people that way, well beyond its own circulation. Is it happening today? Actually, one of the big fans of Ramparts, after it ceased publication, but he cites it as a source of inspiration, is Julian Assange, who said that his WikiLeaks work in some ways is consistent with what Ramparts was doing. Whistleblower stories, dropping the bombs, and you know, you see some of the reactions to WikiLeaks. It's very similar to the reaction, for example, that Time magazine had to Ramparts stories. Time magazine did everything it could to kill the messenger, to target the messenger, Ramparts in this case. They're doing the same thing with Julian Assange today. And if the government was transparent and if the media was doing its job, you wouldn't need whistleblower stories. But Ramparts showed that some very, very important life and death decisions made by the government were being made behind closed doors and for all the wrong reasons.
And so today we do have Truthdig, but we also have Mother Jones that was an offspring of Ramparts, and we also have Rolling Stone that is an offspring of Ramparts, and we have a number of these other kinds of publications on the web. Bob Scheer, let's bring you back in since you did found Truthdig. Today, aside from the WikiLeaks working with The Guardian of London, with New York Times, with Der Spiegel, do you see any of these taking that route? Do you see Truthdig making that kind of an impact?
Yeah, no, but you're right. WikiLeaks is incredibly important, and so was Daniel Ellsberg in revealing the Pentagon Papers, because the fact of the matter is secrecy is the weapon of liars, and, you know, just being the first casualty in war. And what we've learned, the information in WikiLeaks, just as the information in the Pentagon Papers and in the stories we broke about the CIA and Ramparts, the whistleblowers, was all information the public needed to have. This is the informed democracy that Jefferson had in mind as the basis. Otherwise, the whole thing is a charade. And I think Peter actually makes a very good point that the New York Times was intimidated, just as it was after the Iraq War, during the Iraq War. You know, they basically allowed their brains to be embedded in those wars. And what the WikiLeaks reveals is that, hey, it's again a tissue of lies. This is information that's been withheld from us, not because it would jeopardize people's lives and soldiers' lives, but because it would be embarrassing to the people who wield power. That's the critical thing. Now, my optimism comes from the fact that, at least for the time being, with net neutrality hopefully being maintained, but it is in question, we can get the word out much larger than Ramparts was able to do, much wider than they were able to do. And I like the fact that Rolling Stone, in part, came out of it. Jan Wenner was working at Ramparts. I mean, we were a wild bunch. Cy Hirsch, for instance, who became a very important New York Times correspondent, couldn't publish except in smaller he could be heard on KPFA, the original Pacifica, but when we published him in Ramparts, it gave him a much bigger megaphone. So to my mind, there's reasons for optimism now in terms of the Internet, but the sad thing is we're pursuing these wars, and because we don't have a draft, after all, one of the most powerful things we had in Ramparts, we were not anti the GIs. We published a very important cover piece by Don Duncan, a master sergeant who had been in Vietnam, and people like Ron Kovic, who came later, who were veterans and wounded and so forth, telling the truth about the war. Now we don't have a draft, and we have these wars that are treated like video games. And I think the important thing about the WikiLeaks was that it shows what a lie it is, but we somehow don't care that people are dying, Iraqis, Afghanis, and, of course, American soldiers. So, you know, the problem is that we don't have a movement out there. And the same thing has to do with the poverty. Ramparts did a lot on civil rights and poverty. But right now we have, these parallel universes where the leading Democrats go work for Citigroup and come from Goldman Sachs and so forth, and they don't care about the 44 million Americans living in poverty. They don't care about the large number of Black and Hispanic people in our prisons. We have a terrible situation in this country with the economy, but most of the pundits are making out like bandits, and so it's not reported.
So the big one of the big issues is not even so much in mass media as it appears to be in culture and society. Peter Richardson, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I would just add to what Bob said. I mean, you mentioned Rolling Stone and that Jan Wenner was a staffer at the Sunday Ramparts, which was the newspaper spinoff of the magazine at one time. He left with Ralph Gleason, who was also a contributing editor to Ramparts and started Rolling Stone in 1967. But, you know, for a music magazine, it's done a number of very important political pieces. I mean, Jan Wenner said, okay, we want this to be sustainable, and we're going to use the music industry as our advertising base for this. But they continue to weigh in with big pieces. For example, this article on General McChrystal, that actually got General McChrystal fired, which was also one of these stories that was kind of embarrassing. But the main thing is that anybody in the press corps could have done that story, but they would not do it. I don't think there was anything about the author of that story that, you know, that he had any special insight or specific information that wasn't available to anyone else. But because Rolling Stone was in a position to do it without, they don't care about burning sources at the Pentagon or on Wall Street. So they can publish Matt Taibbi and they can publish Michael Hastings and they can drop those bombs and they still have their advertising base. And so that's part of where we are. If we're thinking about the media and the mass media and its situation, we also have to think about how they keep themselves going financially. And that's a very delicate operation for small political magazines, left and right. It's not just the lefty magazines that have a problem with keeping that funding going. You almost have to have that broader cultural outlook, as you mentioned in your question. And in some ways, I mean, Rolling Stone is in a better position to do some of these stories than a lot of other outfits, particularly big mainstream news outlets.
And lastly, is there anybody out there today that is launching the intellectuals, the political leaders, and the new journalists of tomorrow? Bob Scheer, are you doing that?
Of course. Come on. First of all, it's not just the old. I mean, we print. Chris Hedges, every Monday, is on Truthdig. Chris Hedges was fired by the New York Times. He was the best journalist ever. Chris Hedges is the best journalist America has, period. He's a Truthdig regular. He's every Monday because the truth, as Chris Hedges expresses it, was unacceptable to the mainstream media. They want to marginalize him. Why? Because he dared speak the truth at a commencement address, and boom, the New York Times said, shut up or you're out. And he said, well, then I'm out. And we have a lot of younger writers now that are not as well known, but that are writing very important stories. You're right, Truthdig is not alone. There are a lot of good sites on the Internet. I should mention The Nation magazine and so forth. There are plenty of good sites. But the fact of the matter is that we have a hard time. I would just add something that Peter said. It's not just, you have this two-tier society. And people who are making big salaries and have secure jobs and so forth are not feeling the pain out there. They don't feel the pain of a family that thinks that kids has to go into the military to get a job and a career. They don't feel the pain of the people who are unemployed, the people who are living in Venice. I just saw a story about all the people living in mobile homes or out of their cars, just in your own community. So, you know, we have 50 million people who have lost their homes or are deeply underwater on their mortgages, and we don't treat it as a national tragedy. And I think, as I say, the source of optimism for me is that we do have areas where we can express ourselves, thanks to the Internet primarily, but we don't have the ability to connect it with people's real lives in a way. And, you know, of course, that's what you're trying to do with Pacifica. That's what we're trying to do with Truthdig. And I think the strength, I would really recommend that people get Peter's book. Not that it's going to help make a living or anything, but, you know, I
helps
really,
me make a living.
Well, that's what I mean. But I think it's really important to remind people that you don't have to accept it. We invented ramparts, for God's sake. I mean, we didn't, you know, it wasn't given to us. And it's true, it's always difficult to fund these things. You know, the Pacifica is nothing but a fundraising thing all the time, but still does incredibly important work for all of its difficulties. And the fact is, people have to seize the time. They have to use the opening there. So when we heard that Chris Hedges was in trouble with the New York Times, we said, fine, we'll be a home for you. And, you know, millions of people read Chris Hedges, not just on Truthdig, which has been read by, have been visited 50 million unique times, it's mass media, but because everyone steals it or we send it out to the whole world, and people all over the world are reading Chris Hedges, you know, not just on Truthdig, but elsewhere. So people should not be demoralized. And what I love about Peter Richards's book on Ramparts, it shows that you can make room, you can seize the time, you can affect the public, you can energize the public, you can educate, and people should not say, oh, woe is me, the game is rigged and we can't do anything. You know, no, you can do a great deal, and it's a cop-out to stress that the game is rigged. Yes, the game is rigged. Yes, there is big money. But you can find the openings, and you can organize.
Well, that's a perfect place to end. Thank you so much, both of you. The book, again, is called A Bomb in Every Issue, How the Short, Unruly Life of Ramparts Magazine Changed America. We have been speaking with Peter Richardson, the author of that, and also with Robert Scheer, who was one of the editors of Ramparts Magazine and has gone on to write numerous books, found Truthdig Magazine, and co-host Left, Right, and Center. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you, Maria.
When we come back, we are rebroadcasting a look at the entrenched disparities that underlay the events of Ferguson, Missouri. Stay tuned.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Hey, Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In light of the crisis in law enforcement, particularly on the Black community, we are rebroadcasting a look at the disparities that laid the groundwork for what happened in Ferguson.
The Ferguson, Missouri police shooting of Michael Brown has brought to the surface pervasive racial disparities in the United States criminal justice system, its culture, and structures. Our next two scholars have studied the issues extensively. Dolores Jones Brown is a professor in the Department of Law, Police Science, and Criminal Justice Administration at City University of New York. She is the founding director of the John Jay College Center on Race, Crime, and Justice, and the author of the award-winning book, Race, Crime, and Punishment. She's also co-editor of The System in Black and White, exploring the connections between race, crime, and justice, and policing in minority communities. Clarissa Ryle Hayward also joins us. She is a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis. She is the author of How Americans Make Race, Stories, Institutions, Spaces, and co-editor of Justice in the American Metropolis. Welcome, Dolores Jones Brown and Clarissa Ryle Hayward. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with Clarissa Ryle Hayward. You've used this phrase, thick injustice, to describe American cities and suburbs. You've said this is hard to see, hard to change. Now, in some cases, like in Ferguson, the injustice seems pretty obvious. How do you see this thick injustice, particularly in light of what we're witnessing globally when we focus on this incident with Michael Brown?
In Ferguson, right. So that term, thick injustice, is one that I came up with together with a co-author, Todd Swanstrom. And what we were trying to capture is multiple dimensions or aspects of what's sometimes called systemic or structural injustice. In the Ferguson case, we'd be thinking specifically about structural racial injustice. And our idea, the reason we chose the word thick, is that we felt like it captured multiple aspects of what's going on. One is, as you said, these are forms of injustice that are very deep, for instance, that have very long historical roots. Also, that are relatively intractable. They're more difficult than some more blatant or obvious forms of injustice to change. And sometimes, although as you rightly note, not in the past week and a half, they are opaque in the sense that they are more difficult for people to see. So structural forms of injustice were existing in the St. Louis metropolitan area and in St. Louis before the events that erupted in Ferguson. But many people, especially racially privileged people, were unaware of them. And that's the sense in which we mean that they're very often difficult to see.
So the incident actually brought these things to light.
Absolutely, right. And I would clarify that some aspects of racial injustice were salient and not difficult to see for those subjected to it, but for people who are racially privileged in racially privileged parts of the metropolitan area, many aspects of racial injustice that we've been focusing on in the past 10 days, such as racial profiling, especially of young African American men, were invisible to people who lived in more racially privileged parts of our metro area.
Dolores Jones Brown, would you agree?
I do agree, and I'm very happy that the professor sort of clarified at the end that, you know, Black communities have been very clear that these kinds of injustices were going on. And what I'm a little disturbed by is that with all the taping of various incidents across the country, that there are primarily white audiences and even some Black audiences who are still trying to deny the existence of this thick injustice.
Now, the denial is rooted in what? Do you have a sense of why that occurs?
I've been working with a lot of social psychologists, and I think for many whites, they want to believe that America is the utopia of democracy that has been advertised since the beginning of the establishment of the country. And I think for many Blacks, they do not want to accept that despite all of the years of struggle and despite us being about 100 years beyond emancipation, that we are essentially still in the same place that we were in terms of our status as equal citizens.
Now, Dolores Jones Brown, you also worked within the criminal justice system prior to entering academia. What are some of the other aspects that you saw from the inside out that you have then studied as a scholar?
I worked in the Department of Corrections and in community-based corrections for a while, and it's always been clear to me that in terms of sentencing for the same kinds of offenses, people of color almost inevitably receive stiffer sentences. I was profoundly struck by my role as a prosecutor in a local county that the courtroom personnel in my county were predominantly white, and the people we were processing through the court system were predominantly black, and that when, on the few occasions when whites did come through the system, the colleagues who were white were far more empathetic and sympathetic to whatever their plight was than they were to the black defendants.
So now when we go back into how these develop, Clarissa Ryle Hayward, you've written quite a bit about identity, collective identity, institutions and narrative, and how these really become calcified, for lack of a better word. How would you describe this process so that we can understand it?
Yes, let me take a stab at that. The idea there is that many people who write on identity think about identity in terms of people's beliefs, in terms of people's attitudes, in terms of the kind of narratives we tell about who we are. I think that captures a piece of what identity is, but I also think an important part of how identities are kept alive is through institutional forms and through material forms like the urban and suburban spaces that make up our metropolises. So, for example, if you think about the racial identities that are what we're focusing on now, an example of institutions that are extremely relevant that I emphasize in my work are some of the New Deal housing policies that were developed over the course of in the middle decades of the 20th century, which disproportionately favored white Americans over African Americans. And essentially, the language that I would use is they, I think you said, solidified, or they helped to give an enduring power to racial beliefs that were dominant in that part of our history in the early 20th century. So just to give you a very concrete example, if you think about the FHA policies, they essentially gave state-backed mortgages at very favorable rates to white homebuyers. They were explicitly racially discriminatory policies. And if you think about Ferguson, this would have been one of the communities, people in the media have been referring to it as a white flight community, but one of the communities where homeownership was subsidized by the federal government, but specifically for white homebuyers. So I think that that's an example of an institution that helps to shape in certain ways racial identities and specifically inegalitarian racial identities.
Dolores Jones Brown, what would you add?
What has become most disturbing for me is that when I look at the cases of police fatalities, they have cut across all social economic categories. And so this means that the racial identity that may be most predominant in white people's minds of blacks as poor and potentially criminal have actually been projected onto the cases I've studied, a Hollywood actor, police officers, graduate students in college, high school students, insurance salesmen. I want to say this also, both black males and females, because there's a conversation that takes place that says, you know, black males are most at risk for this kind of police encounter. But we've got a growing body of cases that involve black females. And I don't know if you guys have seen the footage of the California Highway Authority officer beating 51-year-old Marlene Pinnock on the side of I-10. The way in which that officer viciously attacks her says that females are also not protected from this kind of police activity. And so, again, what I find most disturbing is there is almost no identity you can have as a black person that will shield you from this kind of over excessive police behavior.
Dolores Jones Brown, you've also written in a couple of articles about how the law is used as a tool that benefits some groups and oppresses others. Now, we see this obviously how it oppresses others. Can you talk a little bit about how it's a tool to benefit the other groups?
I think Professor Hayward actually did a really great job of summarizing some of the economic advantages that whites have been able to benefit from because of things like FHA loans. And in employment, the notion that for a long time job discrimination based on race was permissible and sort of the standard means that whites ended up in positions that they then could pass on an opportunity to become employed to their siblings and later generations through the process of nepotism. And that was something that for blacks did not exist because blacks had been excluded, particularly from professional jobs. And so that's certainly one way in which the laws benefited whites as opposed to blacks. As a criminologist, I am always struck by what I call the abusive use of crime statistics, where we focus on the percentage of criminal offenders who are described as black, and then we make a comparison between that percentage to the small proportion of the American population that blacks make up, which is roughly 12 to 13%. And then we say, well, this is evidence that blacks are involved in most crime or they are more crime prone than whites. But that then means that a large number of white criminals can go into various places like a movie theater, a elementary school, a federal building, and wreak havoc. And they will only be seen as individual white offenders.
Right.
But when a black defendant engages in less atrocious behavior, that behavior is considered a mark against the entire race.
Clarissa Ryle Hayward.
Very often, a law can, on the face of it, seem as if it's race neutral, but it can have completely predictable racially inegalitarian effects. And one example I was thinking of is if you think about, for instance, the mortgage interest tax deduction, that disproportionately benefits people who have the most wealth because they can buy the largest houses with the biggest mortgages. To state it that way, it seems as if this is a race-neutral, although a class-biased policy or law. But in the U.S., whites have the most wealth for many reasons, including that we had a dual housing market in this country just until the late 1960s. So that's an example of a law that one might look at it and say, this is not a racially biased law. But not only is it racially biased, it's racially biased in entirely predictable ways. And due to a long history of racial discrimination, including state-sponsored racial discrimination.
There was a period of time when people believed that we were making very serious progress, and then there was a period that followed it that seemed to exacerbate problems a little bit more. This probably occurred more during the Bush 1 administration, the Reagan administration, where they encouraged local schools and such to fight back against efforts to desegregate. And so now it seems we are facing an era of resegregation, or so I have read. Dolores Jones Brown, would you agree with that?
I certainly would agree with that. And what's sad, and I hate to admit it as a criminologist, that so much of what has been what I call the retrenchment of civil rights achievements has been associated with criminal justice. I think that the work in the 90s of John DiUlio from the University of Pennsylvania and this notion of the coming of the super predators painted black children as potential serious violent criminals. And I think that's part of the reason why we see communities developing resegregated schools, because families are wanting to get their kids away from these potentially dangerous black children.
If we wanted to turn towards solutions to then actually create, you know, what Americans would like to believe the country is, how do we go about doing that? Dolores Jones Brown, you've written a bit about this. You've talked about multicultural competence, particularly within law enforcement communities. How do you see this as a potential solution?
I think it becomes really important for people to recognize and accept, and in particular police officers and other people in positions of power, that difference is not necessarily bad. And I think there's a way in which we have allowed people to accept the notion that any person who's not heterosexual, white, mainstream, middle class, home owning, church going is problematic. If they don't dress the same way that folks who fit in all of those categories would dress. If they don't wear their hair that way, they don't walk that way, they don't raise their families in that way, that there is something problematic with them. And once you add on the historical layer of race, that just exacerbates the situation more and more. And so what multicultural competence training helps police officers and others to understand and hopefully come to accept is that difference is not indicative of a negative trait.
So Clarissa Ryle Hayward, I'd like to turn to you and put this in the context of your big questions that you ask in your scholarship, which is about social power and how it shapes human freedom and how identity fits into this. So how can we contextualize what we're talking about into this idea of social power and human freedom?
Well, there are a lot of different ways to do that. I think if I were going to try to tie those ideas specifically to the issue we've been talking about, you pose this question of, you know, segregation and what looked like progress and then a decline during the latter part of the 20th century. I think that one of the very important mechanisms of power with respect to this question has to do with the way that we delegate authority to make certain kinds of political decisions. We've been having this conversation partly prompted by the discussion of what happened in the St. Louis metropolitan area. And St. Louis is famous or infamous for being one of the most politically fragmented metropolitan areas in the United States. So St. Louis metropolitan area alone has almost 400 local governments. Ferguson is one of those. And if you look at work that demographers do on residential segregation, you know, in the wake of fair housing laws, one of the strongest predictors of racial residential segregation is low-density zoning. So zoning laws that prohibit or very strongly limit multifamily housing would be an example, that require single-family houses, large lots, those sorts of things. If you have a very politically fragmented system of local governance and you devolve to individual municipalities the power to zone, you are going to have municipalities, like extremely wealthy municipalities in the St. Louis metropolitan area, that use this low-density zoning as a way to effectively limit access to the municipality and to the public services that it provides, to limit access to people who are lower income, lower SES. So in terms of change, I would say, you know, an example would be legislation or policies that require inclusionary zoning, that require housing developers who are going to build a new development to include a percentage of units in their development that are affordable units, that are multifamily housing units, that are going to accommodate people from a wide range of socioeconomic groups. So that's one concrete policy change that would help turn around some of this resegregation, was the word that you used. And so when I think about power, I think about it in multiple ways, but I think one particularly salient and important way to think about it is in terms of laws and policies and state-sanctioned forms of power, which can limit or enhance freedom.
And Dolores Jones Brown, let's go back to you. You've talked about culture and training. Are there other aspects of law enforcement structure, culture, and training that you think also need to be addressed?
I think that there is a way in which many large cities, and New York City being one of them, and from what I'm learning about sort of St. Louis and its suburbs, that the power that lies within the decision-making that police departments make creates this dynamic that allows Michael Brown killing to occur and have it then morph into the kind of protest movement that we see, which I think is very important because for so long in major cities, and I have to say I do work with some very progressive major cities where this is not the case, but the notion is that the police department makes a decision about how it's going to police the people. And in the more progressive cities, the police department engage with the community to say, first, what are the problems you see that we need to help you address? And the notion is that the police is providing a service as opposed to playing the role of an occupying army or playing the role as a means of containing and controlling the certain segment of the population so that the more affluent portion of the population can feel more safe, feel more at home, or as we see in many major cities, gentrify areas, force out the socioeconomically disadvantaged and people of color from locations where they've been for generations so that whites can move into those areas and enjoy, whether it's closeness to water, convenience to downtown and their jobs, but that if we don't work with police departments to convince them that the community has a say in how they're policed and that people who are poorer deserve to remain in very various geographic areas, and I really appreciate all the comments that Professor Hayward made about the ways in which power and property and economic well-being becomes the driving force in what's important for Americans, but at the same time, blacks and other racial ethnic minorities are pushed out of those positions of power and those geographic locations.
You bring up this idea of the occupying army. And the reports that are coming out that police are becoming increasingly militarized, do you see that as well?
Yes, and it's an interesting notion that when we being Americans began to adopt the language of war to describe crime fighting or enforcement activities for police departments. So we had a war on poverty, we have a war on drugs, we have a war on terrorism. And all of these wars, of course, suggest that military-style equipment is necessary to bring disorder under control, to bring crime under control. And there's a way in which funding has been funneled into police departments to provide them with these artifacts of war to use against civilians. And I would say on a sort of exaggerated notion that urban crime and urban criminals were so fearless and so much to be feared that the police needed to have this military-styled weaponry to address that issue. And I think, again, this exaggeration occurs in part because of the longstanding historical association of racial and ethnic minorities with hypermasculinity, hyper-aggressiveness, hyper-criminality.
Anything you'd like to add on that, Clarissa Ryle Hayward?
I think those are terrific points. In my work, I've thought a lot about education, and I think there's kind of an overlap in a sense because both the police, which is supposed to be a public service, it's supposed to be something that serves all or serves the community, as Professor Jones Browns was saying. And in, when we talk about education, we also talk about public education. And I think these points raise the question, who is the public? So that word has this connotation of inclusiveness, of something, whether it's protection or security or education, that's for everybody. And I think that when we have public services, if you think, for example, of public schools that essentially are not equally available to everybody or that work for the benefit of some but not others, as Dr. Jones Brown was saying with respect to the police in many urban neighborhoods, this is actually not a public service in the sense of one that is for the community as a whole. And I think our language of calling it public suggests that many of us believe it ought to be. So there's a real tension there between our stated ethical beliefs and our practices.
Clarissa Ryle Hayward and Dolores Jones Brown, thank you so much for sharing your research and your knowledge with us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Dolores Jones Brown is a professor in the Department of Law, Police Science, and Criminal Justice Administration at City University of New York. She is the author of the award-winning book, Race, Crime, and Punishment, and she's also co-editor of The System in Black and White, exploring the connections between race, crime, and justice. Clarissa Ryle Hayward is a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis. She is the author of How Americans Make Race, Stories, Institutions, Spaces, and co-editor of Justice in the American Metropolis.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In light of the crisis in law enforcement, particularly on the Black community, we are rebroadcasting a look at the disparities that laid the groundwork for what happened in Ferguson.
We are joined by Garrett Albert Duncan, Professor of Education and Director of Program in African and African American Studies at Washington University of St. Louis. Duncan has published extensively on Black youth, identity, language, and the social, political, and moral foundations of U.S. public schools. Welcome to the Scholars Circle, Garrett Albert Duncan. It's great to have you here with us.
It's my pleasure.
You have articulated some of the conversations that are going on around the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson as not really being rooted in ignorance or racial animus per se, when people do not understand the racial component of why this occurred. But you say they are rather rooted in another kind of American culture. What is that?
The American culture to which I speak, in fact, when I speak about not rooted in racial animus, I mean more or less very explicit racial animus. In other words, I don't believe the officer said, look, there's a Black guy and I'm going to shoot him because he's Black. But I believe people speak about institutional racism, but I'm speaking about what is called civilizational racism. It's rooted in our metaphors. You've heard Malcolm X and Martin Luther King talk about why is angel food cake white, why is devil's food cake Black, a good lie is a white lie, a bad lie is a Black lie, so on and so forth. So I'm going back to something deeply rooted that becomes part of our common sense and is no longer linked to its racial origins. And I'm talking about something that has been 500 years in the making.
A couple of things I've often thought about when I think about language and how we express racial differences, even using the words Black and white, when that itself seems to create a dichotomy, whereas it seems like if we were to really acknowledge that skin color is a continuum, would we be able to understand race differently?
Well, I don't think so. Keep in mind, race literally refers to two things. It refers to separation. So it's much more than Black and white, and you know, and there's a continuum. But it refers to both a separation and a hierarchy. And so that's where the problem comes in, with the hierarchy from superiority to inferiority. And just to be clear, there's always been hope. You know, there's been these pockets of resistance. For example, in the 1700s, you had people from Europe, Africa, and Asia, as well as here in the First Nation, where we weren't referred to so much by our skin colors, but by our ethnic groups. Like, instead of John the Black Man, it would be John the Evil. And so we were seen as individuals, like other people see themselves as individuals. But something went into the making, which is largely cultural, where those who were once individuals, they become representative of a group, or more or less a social group. So, yes, we could go back and speak in terms of the continuum, but truth be told, and I believe it will be a change in the vocabulary, and, you know, vocabularies change often, but grammars are far less forgiving, and so what you will find, you will still have the grammar of race and racism.
Another aspect of the culture that you have written about in something called The Conversation was really about property rights as a cultural value seen as more important than human rights, and that is part of what is underlying this as well.
Absolutely. In fact, I had this discussion earlier today with a group of first-year students. One of the things, in very concrete terms, we have to recognize that the foundational legal document that informs jurisprudence and even some of our common sense thinking in the United States is the Constitution. And the Constitution favors civil and political rights. But there is another document that is more generally, that addresses things more generally, and I'm talking about the United Nations Declaration of Universal Human Rights. And in the United States, we don't recognize those cultural, social, and economic rights of all folks, including children. So coming back to the United States, we see this historically, I mean, self-evident in the history of chattel slavery, where human beings were seen as property. But even nowadays, women, in terms of their worth, they're not viewed as valuable, and I use that word selectively, as men. Children are not viewed, and in fact, they're seen as commodities, where we talk about them as being our greatest resource, as though they have no intrinsic self-evident value in today. So it's deeply etched. But in the Ferguson situation, it just came out in bold relief. Everything was mobilized around protecting physical property. The arms did not come out to protect residents or other human beings. It was there solely to protect property. And when the property was threatened, then you had the unleashing of the wanton violence upon the residents.
Another aspect that you've written considerably about is how the education system is connected to this inherent injustice. Mm-hmm. How do you connect those two?
Well, two things. First, I actually was on the campus of Normandy High School earlier this year, and that's the school where Michael Brown graduated. And I will tell you, the young people there are marvelous. And, you know, like I expected, that's been a part of my background teaching high school and middle school. So I want to put that out there because there's this notion about the students per se. But then on the other hand, and this is the problem that students and parents have less control over, that much of our educational system is outdated, is still based on a industrial world, a manufacturing world, where we've shifted in terms of our economy and, you know, our way of life to more of a service-oriented, high-tech world. And when you go to a number of these schools, the schools, if they have equipment that can begin to prepare them for this kind of world, the equipment is often dilapidated. I have video footage that will make you want to scream along those lines. And so what happens? You have students doing everything they were told to do, but when they come out, they are underskilled and they are vulnerable. First of all, it's very difficult for them to get gainful employment or to be successful in higher education. And they become vulnerable. It's almost as though we're creating a superfluous or a surplus population. And so the schools are undermining kids by the nature of them being outdated. The education being provided for our children is, for the most part, was fit for the early 1900s and 1950s, and that wasn't good for immigrant kids or for students of color because it prepared them to be second-class citizens, and we have that now.
And so how do we shift the education then? How do we update it so that we are not creating this permanent underclass?
Well, you have pockets of resistance everywhere. And let's be clear, we don't need prescriptions. We don't have to come up with anything magic. You have people all over the United States, whether it's West Philadelphia, Southern California, places here in St. Louis, and in New York. You have perfect role models where you have innovative leaders who have broken their wedding, you know, that are no longer wedded to these really old and outdated ideas. And I will tell you, a central feature in these different successful stories, and I write about those because it's my responsibility to at least offer something, not to make people groan and not want to get up in the morning, but, you know, we have to offer hope. And one of the central features is strong leadership, either at the principal's level, because the principal is on the ground, local, and 8 times out of 10 is usually a woman, and 6 times out of 10 is a woman of color, or someone who's willing to break the rules in the classroom, a teacher who's innovative, who teach the expected skill sets, but will do something else that is novel, that will place their students in a position to be competitive, to either compete with the rest of society, or to be entrepreneurial and to create something. And so we have this happening. These are not celebrated, but they have been written about and have been documented.
Can you give us one really good example?
You know, I was hoping that you would ask. I wish I was there with you so I could show you video and a PowerPoint. But my favorite example, in fact, can I give you 2 examples?
Please.
Okay. My favorite classroom example is what's happening in West Philadelphia, where you have this young teacher teaching kids in an auto repair class or whatever it is, automobile class, and these kids are producing these high-tech soybean-fueled cars. And they're competing with all the major corporations. When you see these cars, they look like Maseratis, Cadillac XLRs. First of all, they look good. So they're not looking like one of these bubbles you wouldn't be found dead in. They look good. They go from 0 to 60 in like 4.5 seconds. And their goal at the last that I was studying them was to get, let me see, I think they wanted to get their cars between 60 to 80 miles per gallon in their car. And these are soybean fuel, so they're green. And these are Black and Latino kids who have been kicked out of school because they were considered to be uneducable. Is that amazing or what?
That's amazing.
Okay, the second example we have around the United States called these promise programs. Now, not all promise programs are as promising as the other ones, but the one in Kalamazoo, you had a special ed teacher who is now superintendent of schools. She went out to the local businesses, private donors, and she got them, and they're all anonymous, to create an endowment that every child that goes through the Kalamazoo public school system and graduates will have up to 6 years of college at any of their public institutions, from community colleges to the University of Michigan, and it'd be absolutely free. Everything is absolutely paid for. And so that means you could have a kid going through and getting a University of Michigan degree, I mean, just changing the quality of life. And what has happened, and this is probably what really touches my heart, was a little kid, it was a kindergartner, he's telling this person, I'm going to college. And then he pauses, he said, I don't know what it is, but I'm going. And so, you know, everybody's laughing. So you have this academic push and you have this hopefulness among parents because you have a number of first generation students potentially, whereas their parents have been sold false promises and disappointed and, you know, have been frustrated. And now it's just, can you imagine, it's like winning the lottery if you know that your child has a chance at a guaranteed education for free when many of our kids are leaving college with a minimum on average of $75,000 in debt. Can you imagine being able to get a degree and without any debt and being able to move on with your life?
That's remarkable. Garrett Albert Duncan, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Garrett Albert Duncan is a professor of education and director of program in African and African American Studies at Washington University of St. Louis. Duncan has published extensively on Black youth, identity, language, and the social, political, and moral foundations of U.S. public schools.
That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.